now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. Are council ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely. My name is James Nutter. Together with my colleague, Mr. Phillips, who's seated at council table, we represent the appellant in this matter, Thomas Baker. This is an appeal from a jury verdict entered in the Superior Court in Sussex County during a rape case. It was a very close case. The appellant, Mr. Baker, was found guilty at trial of one charge of rape in the second degree and two charges of unlawful sexual contact, but found not guilty of four offenses, including what we would submit are the two most serious, the rape first degree charges, the Class A felonies, and also a rape second and a continuous sexual abuse of a child. The matter before the court on appeal is a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. The record, and I would like to first talk about the ground rules, which Judge Graves, the trial judge, laid out very early in this trial. There was a matter early in the trial where the prosecutor elicited some 404B bad act evidence without putting the court on notice. And so very early in the trial, the court said, conducted the Getz analysis, but then said to the prosecutor, if I'm a judge that doesn't like surprises and I don't like to unring bells, and there's procedures that the criminal rules allow for in Rule 404 and 403 and 609, and also in the Delaware Rules of Evidence in Rule 103, which says that to the maximum extent possible in jury cases, the proceedings shall be conducted so as to prevent prejudicial information from coming before the jury by any means necessary. And Judge Graves was explicit early in the trial that that's what he expected of counsel, and I believe that that's what this court expects of counsel, Delaware attorneys appearing in the Superior Court at trial, is to, as this court recently noted in the Miller case, to make proffers of evidence, to the extent possible, to not to put prejudicial evidence before the jury. What is being alleged in this case on appeal is that on two occasions the prosecutor elicited damaging opinions and testimony through mere questioning, which prejudiced Mr. Baker's right to a fair trial. The first occasion occurred when the prosecutor was questioning the defendant's daughter, Patricia Willen. The complaining victim was the defendant's youngest daughter, Ruth Baker, and the prosecutor asked her about a conversation she had with her brother, Sam, well before any allegations had ever been brought before made by Ruth against her father. And the prosecutor asked her, was there a time when you had a conversation with Sam about something you thought may have been occurring, and this isn't exactly from the record, I'm paraphrasing, between your father and Sam? The answer was yes, and the prosecutor followed up with, what did you ask him? And he said, and the question or the response from Ms. Willen was, do you think Dad is messing with Ruthie? There was an objection, although the record doesn't reflect the specific words from Mr. Phillips, I object. It's clear that Judge Graves recognized that injection was being offered because the record reflects that Judge Graves says, I'm going to grant a defense objection to this line of testimony on speculation. They go to sidebar, and there's a lengthy sidebar conference where the prosecutor acknowledges that he doesn't have any basis.
Was there an instruction given after that colloquy?
After that colloquy, Judge Graves advised the jury that that question and answer from the witness was stricken. There wasn't what I would consider to be the typical follow-up instruction, which is the matter's being stricken and you're not to consider the question or the answer as part of your deliberations. He did, as to a previous objection, advise the jury in striking evidence that they were not to consider it as part of their deliberations, to consider either the question or the answer. Our argument here is that just striking it, what that meant to the lay members of the jury may not have been entirely clear, and the focus in misconduct cases is on the curative measures. And so,
I'm sorry, your point is there should have been a follow-up instruction?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's one asked for?
It was not asked for. The second time, I'm sorry, the prosecutor did admit during that colloquy that he did not have a factual basis. And again, there's a long colloquy, a back and forth between the trial judge as to whether or not there was any factual basis for this. The trial judge expressed displeasure with the prosecutor that an opinion for which there was not a factual basis or for which there was not a basis which could be presented or supported by evidence had been offered in front of the jury. And he even went so far as to...
You were getting into the second error.
I'm sorry, I forgot I wanted to go back just briefly, Your Honor. That he even went so far as to sanction, to threaten the prosecutor with a misconduct mistrial if the line of questioning continued. The second time this occurred, the second claim on appeal is that during the defendant's own testimony, he's testifying, he's denying any allegations of improper conduct between himself and his daughter. And during cross-examination, the prosecutor, again without any factual basis, suggests to the jury that the defendant has some familiarity or experience with prior sex offenses. The question was something along the lines of, and you have some familiarity with sex offenses. There are other family members or other friends that you know who have been accused of sex offenses.
Now, our standard of review on what happened or did not happen for that is plain error?
I would submit it's abuse of discretion because there was a timely objection to the question. They go before the trial judge. Again, another long colloquy at sidebar occurs between the trial judge and the prosecutor, and the prosecutor is specifically asked by
sustained,
the trial judge.
Right. Objection sustained.
He did not instruct the jury when they left
sidebar.
Did
he sustain the objection?
He did not even say the words, he sustained the objections. At sidebar, he sustained the objections. He did not instruct the jury that the objection had been sustained. He did not tell the jury that the question had been stricken, and he did not tell the jury that they were not to consider it. So our argument on appeal is that the jury may have, one, considered that the question was entirely proper. It forced Mr. Phillips into a position where he had to object. The question is left hanging in the jury's mind the entire time they're at during a lengthy sidebar. The prosecutor acknowledged...
So our standard of review, again, is plain error for failure to give an instruction because none was requested, was it?
Well, when there's a timely objection, I would submit that...
Was there a request for an instruction or not?
There was not a specific request for an instruction, but if you see in the transcript as you read it, it appears to me that the trial judge may have been exasperated because
I'm sorry to have to press you on this, but I need an answer. Is our standard of review plain error for the failure to give the instruction?
I would say that the standard of review is, again, abuse of discretion because there was a timely objection. There was not a specific request for instruction, so if Your Honor wants to review, if the court wants to review that under a plain error, but the standard of review, as I understand it, in prosecutorial misconduct cases is, one, de novo, and two, an examination de novo to see if it was prejudicial or improper. So it's almost a separate standard of review in prosecutorial misconduct cases. It's reviewed de novo to determine if the conduct was improper and or prejudicial, and that's the Hughes test. So,
were there any sanctions imposed on the prosecutor?
There does not appear to be, and what I would say is that in the Judge Graves, after the prosecutor acknowledges that he had no factual basis to ask this question, Judge Graves goes, it's in the transcript, so long. And like he just dismisses him from the bar, from the sidebar, and it appears to me that he's exasperated because if you read the entire record, the record is full of lengthy exchanges between the prosecutor and the trial judge where the prosecutor is, where the judge is admonishing the prosecutor to accept rulings, that he's in charge of the courtroom, that he's re-arguing rulings that have already been made. He at one point in the transcript, before this questioning had occurred, says, I don't mean to get terse with you, but will you ever accept an adverse ruling? It's not just this judge that you're bumping heads with. Let's stop re-arguing.
Does any of that matter?
I think it matters, Your Honor, because when they're at the bar arguing this question and whether or not there was a factual basis for it, When the prosecutor acknowledges that there was no factual basis, it appears from the record that they were just dismissed with the judge saying, so long, I thought something may have come out during the police investigation.
Okay.
We're not going down this road.
Let me ask a different but related question. Let's assume for the moment that we are not talking about prosecutorial misconduct. We are talking about a question that you object to, all right, as being improper but not prosecutorial misconduct improper. And the court sustains your objection. In your view, do you then have an obligation to ask for some sort of relief in the nature of, you know, a curative instruction or some admonition to the jury about that this is stricken, or have you preserved all of your rights simply by making the objection and then letting the judge do whatever the judge chooses to do? And if the judge doesn't, for example, give a curative instruction, then argue on appeal that the absence of a curative instruction is abuse of discretion as opposed to plain error. I'm getting at the standard of review, because arguably there are two phases to this. There is whether there was any objection at all, where clearly we'd be in a plain error standard of review, or as seems to have happened here, where there was some level of objection to what was happening, but then no request for a curative instruction. Do we separate the two and say, okay, since you didn't request a curative instruction, we act as if there never was an objection, and therefore we review the absence of a curative instruction for plain error?
Well, I think when there's a timely objection that the court sustains, there's a dual responsibility, I would submit, and there is a responsibility on counsel to act if he's not getting the relief from the trial judge that he believes is necessary to make the request. In the context of this case, however, with the full record, with these exchanges between these lengthy exchanges between the prosecutor and the trial judge, it appears that they were dismissed from the bar without, and just going back into the trial, and everybody moved along to the next stage of proceedings, and then in looking at the record.
But you're not answering my question. I understand that you're saying that this was a contentious kind of trial, apparently, and that there was some frustration, it appears, on the part of the trial judge and lengthy sidebars and all of that stuff. I don't care about that. I'm asking you about whether there is a bifurcated requirement here that, A, you have to make an objection if you want to preserve for review other than plain error, and B, you have to ask for relief if you want to argue that you should have gotten that relief other than on a standard of plain error. Is that how you understand the law to be or not?
I understand the law to be that an objection is the method by which you preserve something for appellate review, is that you object to it. There was an objection to this in relevance, and the state has made the claim that he didn't object on a certain grounds. He objected on relevance grounds rather than unfair prejudice grounds. The objection, I would submit to this court, is sufficient to preserve the claim for appellate review.
If that's right, then what you're arguing is that once defense counsel makes the objection, then it's the trial judge's duty, sua sponte, to grant a curative instruction or suffer the risk of reversal not on plain error grounds but for abuse of discretion. Is that right?
It's difficult.
Is that right?
I would say that the trial judge has to give something when an objection is made and sustained or appears to be sustained, that there has to be
Does he have to do that over the objection of defense counsel? Because sometimes defense counsel may, for tactical reasons, not want to have a point emphasized, such as, members of the jury, the prosecutor just explained that this defendant may have other sex offenses in his background. You're to disregard that. I mean, doesn't that sort of underscore the damage?
It could, Your Honor, but here we're dealing with a situation where the prosecutor is asking questions for which there was no basis at all, in fact, and he's doing it contrary to what the rules are in Delaware. There's no balancing test. There's no notice. Justice Steele, in his opinion in Long, when he was on the Superior Court, said in cross-examination, asking improper questions on cross, really deprives the court of the opportunity to shield the jury, to allow counsel to make a timely objection, and it prevents the court from having the opportunity to shield the jury from having to consider this.
Mr. Nutter, I just want to point out that you're in rebuttal.
I see that, Your Honor. I do want to just go one bit further to note that we didn't address in the brief whether or not it was plain error or abuse of discretion because of what the court says in all the cases say is the standard of review of prosecutorial misconduct, and that is it improper or prejudicial, and then if so, the court reviews it for using the Hughes test, the closeness of the case, the centrality of the issue affected, and the curative measures. And so what I would submit to the court is focusing on here is what are the curative measures. But the standard of review is what's laid out in Weddington and all the other prosecutorial misconduct cases, and that the last question this court, or what this court is focused on primarily in this argument, is what were the curative measures.
Thank you.
I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
May it please the court. My name is Kim Evanson, and I represent the state in this matter. The state disagrees that the standard of review is what is found under Hughes in a prosecutorial misconduct case. I think the state believes the standard of review is plain error because this is not a situation where the defendant objected, made a timely objection, as to the first question that on appeal he now claims is improper when the prosecutor asked Patricia Willen about a conversation she had with her brother in the driveway. There was no objection. It was the court who sua sponte, the trial judge who sua sponte, interrupted the...
Well, let me ask you about that because here we may have the problem of a written transcript as being dispositive. If an attorney is getting to his feet, for example, in preparation of raising an objection, and if the nature of the question or the nature of the answer is such that the court kind of immediately says, whoa, you know, this is not going to be permitted, it is possible that without ever articulating an objection, somebody who was sitting there would understand that the attorney had planned on objecting and was in the process of starting to object when the court just jumped in and ruled.
That is a possibility, and I don't think, however, from the record, when the prosecutor was examining Patricia Willen, that would be an inference the court should make, because they go on and on, question, answer, before the trial judge says anything. So it doesn't seem like it's an instantaneous, and I refer to pages A64 and A65 in the opening appendix, that the defense counsel was rising to his feet.
Well,
I don't think that's fair.
There was a sua sponte objection by the court.
I believe it was a sua sponte objection based on this record.
And that should have the same legal effect as an objection by counsel, should it not?
But in terms of...
as a general matter.
As a general matter, the court's...
the purpose of a lawyer objecting is to alert the court that there's something to be ruled on. If the court's already alerted...
That's correct.
Then that purpose is served.
But for the defense now on appeal to say this is prosecutorial misconduct, and we have a whole different standard of review when what took place was the court sua sponte interrupted the prosecutor, asked for the factual basis, what was the question, what was the opinion that was elicited, and then subsequently struck the question, struck the answer, informed the jury that the opinion regarding Patricia Willen as to the sexual, any sexual relationship between the defendant and his daughter was stricken.
Well, that may go to whether or not the error, if there is error, was prejudicial. But does it really go to the standard of review?
Well, I think in this case it does, because the one of the complaints raised on appeal was that the curative instruction, there was no curative instruction, that saying this is stricken was not enough, and therefore there was all this prejudice. So if we're going to measure prejudice, we have to look to see what took place in the record. And there we go. The judge cured any prejudice by instructing the jury to that this was stricken. Now, as to whether this was prosecutorial misconduct, the argument
you're saying it really doesn't matter whether it was, or are you saying that? I mean, I understand your argument that what the judge did in response to the question was sufficient to cure any prejudice, if there was any prejudice. But are you now going on and suggesting that the result might be different if the standard of review were prosecutorial misconduct?
I think since there was never a claim raised below by defense.
I mean, are we talking now about an issue that matters?
An issue that matters.
Yes. If the standard of review is prosecutorial misconduct and the facts remain the same, is the outcome different?
No.
So why does it matter whether we're talking about prosecutorial misconduct?
Well, I think because, again, you have a situation where the defense never objected to what the prosecutor was doing, and that on appeal to claim that this was prosecutorial misconduct.
You're talking as to the first set of questions.
Yes, Your Honor, I am, as to the first. And as to the second.
So they shouldn't be heard to argue that.
Correct. I'm sorry if I confused you. It was not my intent. But, I mean, we have a situation.
Happens all the time.
To me.
Let me ask you, I'm thinking of the second situation now, and to help me work through the standard of review, let me put a question to you along these lines. Let's assume hypothetically that the prosecutor said, Mr. Baker, you've been convicted of this offense before, haven't you? Okay, and then that's the question. And the judge reacts to that, sustains the objection, and no curative instruction is given. What is our standard of review in that circumstance? I'm trying to phrase it in a way that there's no doubt. It's an improper, prejudicial, mistrial type of question. You've been convicted of this offense before, haven't you? What's our standard of review?
Well, you said the word, I think, Your Honor, mistrial. Did the defendant get up and say, Your Honor, I move for a mistrial?
Well, assume he didn't. Assume he did not. That the objection is made and the objection is sustained, and no curative instruction is given. And now the matter's on appeal for us, saying a new trial should be ordered because of that question.
Well, I think in to put it in a context that I would understand it the best would be plain error, because he should have asked for a mistrial, because that's ultimately, let's reverse this because of prosecutorial misconduct, should have been asked, and the question is, was this a mistrial situation? And since it wasn't requested of the court, it's a plain error standard of review.
But that's not what the prosecutorial misconduct cases say, though.
Well, they do go into it. I think this is an area of the law that's very nebulous, in the sense that, yes, prosecutorial misconduct, the court has the precedent of Hughes and Weddington and other cases and cites the Hughes test. But we get into a situation where at trial none of these objections are raised, and then on appeal it's in hindsight, oh, I should have claimed this was prosecutorial misconduct, this was grounds for a mistrial, this was so overwhelmingly prejudicial, when if you look at the record as to what went on, the judge said nothing, the defense counsel said nothing, it was dealt with as, this isn't relevant, I think there's a potential for jury confusion, let's move on, let's go on. So looking at the trial judge, who was in the best position to know or sense whether this was so highly inflammatory and prejudicial, there's no further reaction.
I'd like to follow up on Justice Ridgely's question. If I got the drift of your response to my last question, it is that if there is to be a used standard of review on appeal, then that standard of review has to be triggered by some objection to the effect that what the prosecutor was doing is prosecutorial misconduct. The question that Justice Ridgely asked assumes that that the question that was asked is self-evidently misconduct, because any even rookie prosecutor should know that you don't ask a question like that. What is your position in those circumstances?
Well, I think under a plain error standard of review, you could still reach the same result following the Hughes test.
All right. I'm thoroughly confused. What I was wondering, and what I think Hughes and some of the other cases in this area suggest, is that prosecutorial misconduct is in a class of its own in terms of the review that's given by this court, and that it, not every case where a bad question is asked rises to the level of prosecutorial misconduct by any means. So it wouldn't work, if you will, as a standard of review, except in those cases where the facts, as Hughes, you know, articulates the factors to look at, where it was that prejudicial and that central and the case was close and that sort of thing. Doesn't that take it out of abuse of discretion, plain error, that whole business, because it's a special area of the law that has special rules to it?
Well, is it so? Excuse me, Your Honor. A special area of the law, that is indeed the way it appears to be, but it's also a risky proposition, because then where does the court, I mean, the problem the state has is where do the prosecutors, where do the trial judges, where does the court draw the line between a bad question, an inartful question, a question asked in good faith, but perhaps because lack of, you know, focused thinking at that moment, at the intense moment of the trial, or lack of sufficient preparation of that particular witness, it becomes a question that, oops, shouldn't have asked. And I think that is something that you have to look to see what the trial judge reacted and how the trial judge reacted. And to say in hindsight that this was fishing or there a lack of good faith in asking a question for which there was no factual basis is easy to say in hindsight, and then triggers the entire Hughes analysis, close case, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think, you know, this is perhaps the perfect example. Two isolated incidences, two isolated questions by the prosecutor, one to a prosecution witness, the other during cross-examination of the defendant himself. Each time the trial judge stepped in and stopped it, and in one case specifically struck it and informed the jury that the question and the answer was struck. In the other case, during the analysis of the, where was the prosecutor going with this question, the prosecutor explained where he was going. And the judge said, well, that's kind of clever, but I think it's going to confuse the jury. And this is one of those situations, 403, where I don't normally, stop something on the grounds of relevance, but there's potential for jury confusion here. So let's go on.
Well, this question, and you have some familiarity with sex offenses, there are other members that you know, other friends, other people that you know have been accused of sex offenses. Doesn't that leave the clear impression that the defendant has a criminal history of sex offenses and that he associates with sex offenders?
Your Honor, I disagree.
Is that one inference that can be drawn?
It is perhaps an inference that could be drawn. But in this case, I mean, the prosecutor stumbling over his, well, perhaps not stumbling, but trying to craft a question, was referring to, as he explained during the sidebar, did he know of other people accused of sex crimes? Did the defendant know of other people? Not was the defendant convicted of other sex crimes? And as the state pointed out, although no curative instruction was given at that time, the jury was subsequently instructed that questions are not evidence. Only the answers are. So when you look at it, when you look at this case, I mean, the jury was, the defendant was charged with seven offenses. And four of those charges, he was acquitted of.
All right, so a curative instruction can work in certain cases. So doesn't the issue boil down to whether this question and these two questions and the impression they left are presumptively prejudicial, that a curative instruction would not work to cure that?
Well, in the first question, there was an instruction that it was stricken, not the follow-through, you are not to consider this, if that's the curative instruction that you are referring to, Your Honor.
I'm referring to the second set of inquiries, the one about familiarity with sex offenses.
Familiarity. Again, I think Your Honor gave an example. You've been previously convicted of sex offenses, haven't you? That would be so obvious. That might be a situation where no curative instruction could evaporate the prejudice, but not in this situation. Not where what he's asking is, do you know of others who have sex crimes in their background? I mean, you have a situation where the defendant got on the stand and said he instructed his wife to take his daughter to the hospital to be checked if she was a virgin. It was an unusual, to say the least.
Was it in the record what the defendant's occupation and background was? I mean, did the jury know, for instance, that he was not a psychologist or a counselor for child sex victims? He was not a prosecutor who prosecuted sex offenses. He was not a defense lawyer who defended people accused of sex offenses. Were they able to infer all of those exclusions in terms of what he did for a living in the context of this question? You have some familiarity with sex offenses.
Well, the jury was informed that he was a trucker, I guess you would describe it as a long distance or a long haul trucker. To the extent that individuals who are not lawyers, judges, prosecutors, or psychologists are familiar with sex offenses, I think perhaps people watch television, and that's not in the record. No one asked him, do you watch television? But whether or not, you have a situation where you have a prosecutor dealing with a defendant who's gotten on the stand and exposed himself, opened himself up to cross-examination, a situation where you've got a family, a large family, where there have been instances of outright disbelief expressed by members of the family as to the girl's allegations against her father.
Are you saying that this question was invited by some part of the direct examination?
The direct examination, it was invited in that he explained, he testified on direct, the defendant did, that he had his wife take his daughter to the hospital or to a doctor to be checked as to whether or not she was a virgin. And this was before the allegations came out. And what the prosecutor was trying to do was to inquire whether this was prompted by some knowledge on the defendant's part that if a child was not a virgin, then any allegation of sexual abuse would be his word against her word. And that given the background, the allegations, the history of messing with her, his messing with her, that this was almost, and I'm extrapolating a little bit, that this would provide him with a cover for, aha, now I can have sexual intercourse. Because the young woman had indeed testified that it had started out with touching, fondling, and then progress to actual sexual intercourse.
One follow-up question to a question that Justice Berger asked. I believe that you responded that, yes, if you're in use standard of review territory, that's a special area of the law. It's different from the ordinary standards of review that apply in criminal appeals. But you go on to say in order to invoke that standard, it has to be preserved in an appropriate way at the trial level. What my question is, suppose it had, and we were to apply the U standard, would it make any difference as far as the outcome is concerned? Is that a case dispositive standard in this case?
I guess I would have to agree it would not make a difference ultimately if it had been preserved, but I think it would have given the state the opportunity to make a fuller record. Because what is going on appeal now involves accusations of lack of a factual basis, lack of a good faith basis. So the prosecutor does not have an opportunity to defend himself or herself at the trial level and explain what the basis of these questions were. That's where, if you will, the unfairness of applying that standard of review when at the trial level there has been no opportunity to explain why. Questions?
Thank you.
Asked. We would submit that, appellant would submit that this is not a case of hindsight and that in any fashion that the prosecutor did not have a full opportunity to proffer to the court the basis. Judge, as to the first question, series of questions, Judge Graves specifically asked the prosecutor, do you want to proffer to me the basis for this question, the basis for this opinion that you've just elicited from this witness? And the prosecutor said he didn't know if there was a basis. And that's when there was a lengthy admonishment from the court, you do not fish in front of the jury. I'm not happy with the fact that you've just elicited this opinion for which you don't have a factual basis. And he was given every opportunity as to the first series of questions to Patricia Willen. And as to the second series of questions to the defendant himself, he was given every opportunity as well because Judge Graves at sidebar said to him, do you even know what the answer to the question is going to be? And the prosecutor's response was, how would I know? So the ability to prejudice a defendant in this case the defendant, through questioning alone is so recognized that there's an ABA standard, and that is ABA standard 5.7D for the prosecution function.
So you're saying, in this case at least, it was the trial judge that put the prosecutor on notice of the nature of the problem. Prosecutor had the opportunity to cure the problem if there was a cure and did not avail himself of it.
He certainly had every opportunity.
Yes?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. He had every opportunity to proffer to the basis. This wasn't just an inartful question. It was a whole out-of-bounds area to which the prosecutor was going into with no factual basis whatsoever.
Well, I'm sorry.
I want to turn to the Hughes standard for a moment. The state points out that your client was not convicted of all charges, and that sometimes is a factor that's looked at as a way of satisfying the court that this jury was not prejudiced, that the jury sifted through and decided, yes, there's enough evidence on this charge, no, there's not enough evidence on that charge, which is inconsistent with the underpinning of a misconduct charge, which is that, you know, this jury was just given such prejudicial information that it couldn't come to a fair result anymore. We can't be confident that it came to a fair result. Here we've got a jury that parsed out several charges and exonerated or found your client not guilty on some of them. doesn't that go a long way towards suggesting that this does not meet the Hughes standard?
I would suggest it does not for this reason. He was found not guilty of four offenses, guilty of three. But that, in this case, is to be taken, we would submit, as evidence of just how close this case was. And the record is also clear that originally the jury sent out a note saying we cannot reach a unanimous verdict on all counts. So originally they were hung, and then it's clear that this is a compromise verdict because they found him guilty of a rape second and two sexual contact charges, but not guilty of a continuous sexual abuse, which as a predicate would require three separate incidents. So it's I think the court should look at it as evidence of just how close the case was and that this was a compromise verdict. There's an ABA standard, and Delaware Rules of Evidence suggest that you don't go into these this type of questioning without making offers or putting the court on notice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and have a brief recess.
Please rise.